And now for reading and writing and radio.
"Glorious, stirring sight, a motor car," murmured Toad, never offering to move. "The poetry of motion, the real way to travel, the only way to travel. Here today and next week tomorrow. Villages skipped, towns and cities jumped, always somebody else's horizon. And to think I never knew, all those wasted years that lie behind me, I never knew, never even dreamt. But now that I know, now that I fully realize, oh, what a flowery track lies spread before me henceforth. What dust clouds shall spring up behind me as I speed on my reckless way. Oh, bliss! Oh, poop, poop! Oh, my! Oh, my!"
That harmonious madness flows from the lips of Mr. Toad in Kenneth Graham's The Wind in the Willows. But do you have a passion, too?
WSSR Radio at Sangamon State University presents Reading and Writing and Radio, a program about creative writing. Your host is Jacqueline Jackson, children's author and professor of literature at Sangamon State University.
Spring. For several springs now, I've bicycled in the south of England, and it's a wonderful way to travel, especially in a country that has a network of little-traveled, narrow country lanes, usually hard surface, with brambly hedges rising up on either side that are fragrant with hawthorn blossoms and bright with wildflowers. Up above, just little specks in the sky, the larks are singing, so that you can understand the poets. I had to memorize in seventh grade Shelley's Ode to a Skylark that starts, "Hail to thee, blithe spirit, bird thou never wert, that from heaven or near it pourest thy full heart in profuse strains of unpremeditated art." And our teacher explained that six-syllable word to us, unpremeditated, meaning that you don't think about it ahead of time. And the last verse starts, "Teach me half the gladness that thy brain must know," or heart, I think, "such harmonious madness from my lips would flow." And then when you're bicycling, a hedge or a wall will open up and you'll have a glimpse of checkered fields or a woods with a floor of bluebells so blue that it's like a misty blue carpet, or a vista over a wide valley to a hill with a prehistoric horse carved, that they carved by lifting the sod off the white, chalky stone that's underneath. And every few miles you pedal into a little village with good things to eat in the small stores, and there's sometimes thatched roofed houses, and in the bigger towns a cathedral or a museum or a castle to see. But you don't get tired of seeing things because you have to cycle to get to them, so that you have spaces of good exercise in between, and you don't overload your circuits, with all there is for a tourist to see. And then at night, you stay in a youth hostel, and you take your chances on the one supper that the warden makes for everybody, or else you make your own in the immaculate members' kitchen with its row of little burners, a stove for everybody, lamb chops or sausages, or more likely, since you're never far from the sea in England, a kipper or grilled sole or haddock, and a big loaf of crusty bakery brown bread. I think you can tell that I'm keen about bicycling in southern England. At one youth hostel last spring, there was staying a large group of kids and a couple of parents and teachers with them. This hostel wasn't an old mansion or a mill or a castle or a remodeled merchant's warehouse or a glove factory as so many other hostels that I'd stayed in. This one had been built specially in order to make sleeping accommodations for large groups near a very special and relatively new spot, a wildfowl trust on the Severn River in the west of England. A trust is a sanctuary. This place, Slimbridge, is world famous. It was started both to give a refuge to ducks and geese and flamingos, swans, cranes. every other kind of wildlife in a world that's rapidly destroying their habitats, but also to study these birds, their migratory patterns, their breeding habits, and to save birds from extinction by getting them to breed in captivity. Slimbridge has had considerable success in saving birds on the brink, increasing their numbers, and the ultimate goal is repopulating areas of the globe where the bird has died out, this time in protected areas on these islands or jungles or swamplands or wherever. And if the birds can't yet go home again, not safe there yet, why, Slimbridge will keep them and keep breeding them until they can. It's a magnificent place to visit. Birds everywhere. You can buy a bag of wheat, like popcorn, to feed them. And some will eat out of your hand, and some will chase you and attack your tennis shoes. That's the swans. They're nasty-tempered. And some won't pay you any attention, but will still eat the wheat that you scatter. And there's great areas where there are four different kinds of flamingos, like pools of pink, all with their heads upside down on their long necks, eating upside down by filtering the flamingo soup through their bills, a broth that they make up out of water and crushed shrimp and shellfish and vitamins and other goodies to feed to flamingos in captivity. They pour them into sort of concrete, shallow pools, and the flamingos stand in them. A wonderful place, and started by Sir Peter Scott, who's son of the Antarctic explorer, but that's a different story. Anyway, these kids I met, I knew they could only be at this hostel because they'd come to visit Slimbridge. That's why I was there. And so, since this is one of the nice things about hostels, people are so friendly, we got talking. And it turned out that they were a club from 60 or 70 miles away, a village, a young ornithologist's club. The kids were about third grade up through seventh or eighth grade, and about an equal number of boys and girls. Ornithology is the study of birds. So an ornithology club is a club to study birds. And as I talked to these kids, I became more and more impressed with how much they knew about birds, how much they'd studied and watched and visited. Out early, up late for owls, their notebooks and binoculars and bird books and cameras as their traveling equipment. So I grabbed up my tape recorder and I made a tape for all you reading and writing and radio listeners. And the young ornithologists enjoyed doing it. We sat around the rec room and I interviewed them. And you would enjoy their hearing their names and their accents and what they do as bird watchers, as ornithologists. They were neat kids. But my tape quality isn't good enough, and you would be frustrated by listening. So instead I'm telling you, and it's a substitution that I wish I didn't have to make. Well, I was impressed with the knowledge that so many of them showed, but I was especially impressed with the keenness of all of them, even the littlest. They were really interested. They were really dedicated. Keen. That's a word the British use a lot, more than we do. And it means being highly interested, enthusiastic, motivated, caring about. Toad in The Wind in the Willows, his most endearing quality is this keenness, his passion, first for boats, then for caravans, then for motor cars. Even if it is a somewhat fickle passion, he goes from love to love, except they all seem to be forms of transportation. If Kenneth Graham were writing today, I think that Toad would progress to being an astronaut. But to have enthusiasm after enthusiasm is okay in my mind, especially when you're young, when you're learning about everything and finding everything, I hope, so interesting that you can hardly stand it. But it's also okay when you're middle-aged and old to keep alert to the world about you, to develop new areas you're keen about, that you pursue with young ornithology or toad vigor and passion. So much to see and do and learn before we die. I plan to be a toad all my life. Far better enthusiasm than boredom, even if we do flit from one bright attractive flower to the next attractive flower. But often, like these ornithologists, we focus on something that isn't just a passing fancy, that we really dig into. We don't notice the next flower because we're so absorbed in this one, or we don't notice it much. In my teens, it was playing the cello, and it was stars. I was a young astronomer. I read every book I could find. I spent hours on the lawn at night with binoculars and star maps. I even sent for a book on how to build a telescope. But I was discouraged at the tiny print when it came, and all the mathematics that I couldn't yet understand, and some of it I never could understand, the enormity of the project, discouraged me, and not the least of the difficulties was getting the proper chunk of glass to grind. This was really a project for a club or for older people, and there wasn't any young astronomy club. But I took astronomy in college, and I've continued the interest. I took Charlie Schweighauser's class on Halley's Comet here at Sangamon State last fall, and 2 weeks ago I was up at 4 o'clock several different mornings down at the telescope, and I made Marcy in my book, The Paleface Redskins, an astronomy nut. The kids in the story are playing Indians. Her name is White Feather, and they sneak into the Boy Scout camp, she and the rest of the tribe, and spy on the campfire session, and the speaker brings out a telescope. An electric thrill jolted White Feather. A telescope, the fiercest longing she had ever gripped her. "Cabbage," muttered Owl Eyes, "a star talk. Well, let's go." "Ugh, follow me," Chief Thundercloud crept away. "Wait," White Feather grabbed Owl Eyes' sweater. "We can't leave now. It's a telescope, a telescope." "So what? Come on." "We can't," cried White Feather, but the rest were gone. With a despairing look at the gleaming tube, she crawled reluctantly after them. Woods closed in. The tribe stood and walked freely. Well, later on, she comes back at night all by herself when she hears there's going to be a star talk, and she sneaks in with the Boy Scouts, and she's disguised so that they can't tell that she's a girl. And she listens to the rest of what's going on at the council. She drowsed until a new voice, warm with interest, startled her awake. The Star Counselor. She crept farther forward. He was talking simply of the planets, their distances, how they might have been formed, the hot cinder Mercury, cloudy Venus, Earth's twin, red Mars with its ice caps and strange markings, the asteroids swirling out there in space, some no bigger than a grand piano, the disintegrated remains, perhaps, of a planet like Earth, the 9 moons of cold Jupiter, Saturn's remarkable rings, the sensational discovery of little Pluto. He spoke of other suns and solar systems, black cosmic clouds, cold dwarf stars, flaming novas, other galaxies, the space, the stretch, the infinite. You see, I wrote this before there were any black holes, or I would have had that there. Marcy sat enthralled. She'd heard lots of it before at school, but science class was not held on a windy hill with stars twinkling overhead. It had never seemed as awful as now, under the very planets where the black reaches of space reached out and on forever. And so she sits there being enthralled, and finally she gets her chance to look through the telescope at the moon. Before her hung an uneven section of orange. It was the familiar moon, but oh, how unfamiliar. The man in the moon spots were planes, cut with long gashes and pimpled with craters. It gave her an odd feeling of distance, at once so close and yet so far. And seen this way, the moon did not seem to give off light at all anymore, but was simply hanging there in the light. She had known. Now she could see the truth. She swallowed. It's, her voice was husky. "Pretty wonderful, isn't it?" agreed the boy. "Here, I'll show you something else." And he shows her the Big Dipper. "Look hard at it. See anything? The star where the handle bends?" Marcy squinted and suddenly grinned. "Another star, just above. That must be the papoose." She blushed. "The Indians called that star the old squaw with the papoose on her back, but I never noticed there was a papoose till just now." The boy looked curiously at her. "Well, the Arabs called it Alcor, means the rider. Same idea. It shows you've got good eyes, but here's something the Indians never suspected. Take a look at the old squaw in the telescope." She peeped. Thousands of light years away in the night, 2 fiery globes rubbed surfaces. Nearby gleamed a fainter star. "See," said the counselor, "Alcor's rotating around a double star, 2 suns. You can't see that with the naked eye." And the scene goes on until she finally sees Saturn at the climax of it. And she thanks the counselor. The balloon in her stomach swelled a fraction larger and burst. "Thank you," she gasped, "thank you." Her hood fell back and her braids swung free as she ran blindly toward the hill. She crashed through the woods, her ears pounded, and she burned all over. She barely felt the ground beneath her feet. She stumbled through brambles and pitched over logs, climbing up and running on, beating down the flaming excitement that was at the same time consuming her and charging her with energy. "Saturn," she panted, "Saturn, Saturn." So you see, Toad. She is a toad about the stars. Well, That's the way I expressed it in my book and the way I felt when I first saw Saturn. When I was in high school, there was a boy named John Edwards who was keen on opera. My sister and I were musicians, but we didn't know anything about opera, and we didn't care, really. But John was a passionate toad, and he didn't keep love of opera to himself. He shared it. He forced it. He compelled it. He needed a group, and we were that group. He came out to our house in the country. He brought records. He played them. He told us stories. He drilled us on the light motifs. Now every time that you hear that little phrase twined in the music, he'd tell us it means Siegfried's coming. You're probably familiar with Peter and the Wolf, and every time Peter's coming, you hear that little tune, yum dum da 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 da. Well, there were little tunes like that in the opera telling that Siegfried was coming. And John arranged a trip 100 miles to Chicago to see a real opera, and he lectured us on it, and he played us the music, and we all went in on the train, and we saw Wagner's The Valkyrie, and we vastly enjoyed it. And it was so long that we missed the train home because we couldn't bear to miss the ending when Brunhilde dies and lies on her funeral pyre, and actual flames, real flames right there on the stage, rise up all around her as she sings her farewell song. We had to take the milk train home at 4 a.m. I owe my appreciation to opera to John Edwards's keenness, and I've always been grateful to him. I said, "I don't care about opera. It's dumb, all that singing." And he said, "How do you know you don't care? You don't know anything about it. I'll show you what's wonderful about it. How can you tell till you really know?" And he was right. Once I knew something, I became keen, and the more I knew, the keener I became. Never as keen as John, but it certainly has added a dimension to my life. And that taught me a lesson that I've found true all my life. Most things that I don't think are interesting is because I haven't given them a chance. As soon as I dig in and start to explore it, it becomes interesting. I said as soon as, but sometimes it takes a while, sometimes quite a while. For with certain things, you have to work with them. You have to study, to learn, to get far enough into a subject for it to reach its cautious tentacles out and touch you and then embrace you, and finally you and it become one. It doesn't necessarily grab you the first time that you sniff near it. And the embrace is sometimes for a lifetime. And sometimes it turns into your life work. But even if it doesn't, it does enrich your life in all sorts of ways, like opera did for me. So that's my message for today, and from the young ornithologists. Pursue your loves. Spend time on them. If you think you haven't any, then turn off the TV. Take time to pursue something that might be interesting. Give everything a chance. Stick with it long enough and learn enough about it that you begin to see what's interesting. Infect your friends. Hit them over the head with your interest. Make them interested, too. Even form a club. I know that a lot of you already have strong interests, and that's what I'd like to hear about in your writing today. What are you keen on? Chess? Ice skating? Building models? Raising sheep, like Bella, who writes in from Beeson? Write down your passion and give us plenty of details. How you came to be interested, where you learned more about your interest, who helped you, what you do to pursue this interest. Do you go on trips with your bird glasses? What makes it so fascinating and important to you? Does it challenge your mind like chess, your body and your mind like gymnastics? For any athlete will tell you a physical skill requires an alert mind controlling the body. Does it expand you? Do others share your interest? Write it down. And see if by your words you can be compelling to the listener. So we'll say, "That sounds fascinating. I don't know much about it, but I think I'd really like to explore it. It certainly captured Joan or John, and there's so much more to know about it than I realized and to do." People who are keen on something, like the skylark, have blithe spirits. They don't have time to be bored or to spend precious long hours flipping channels. So I say, hail to thee, blithe spirits. You are the soarers and the singers. You have something to be glad about. Give us some harmonious madness, in your words, about your interest.
W. WSSR Radio has presented Reading and Writing and Radio. Send your writings to Jacqueline Jackson, Sangamon State University, Springfield, Illinois, 62708.